Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Politics. Energy transition to be topic in presidential race. Industry has long history of transitioning to new forms. By Mella McEwen, MMCEWEN at MRT.com. Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden laid out his energy plan last month. President Trump followed by pledging support for the oil and gas industry during his visit Wednesday to the Permian Basin, the nation's largest oil and gas producing region. The energy debate has been joined, said Daniel Yergin, vice chairman of IHS Market and author of the upcoming book, The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations. He said voters should see energy and energy transition as a major topic of debate in the 2020 presidential election as never before. Biden's $2 trillion plan promotes electric vehicles, energy efficiency, and aims for net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050 through using less fossil fuel. He also emphasizes mass transit, expanding solar wind farms, and building electric vehicle charging stations. Trump calls for opening additional areas of the nation for oil and gas exploration, promotes exporting U.S. crude and natural gas, and touts the nation as the world's leading oil and gas producer. Just as shale oil dominated energy discussions, especially with regards to the Permian's unconventional shale growth, energy transition is running neck and neck as the phrase most commonly used in discussions involving energy. It is the subject of great discussion, but there's not a lot of agreement on what it means. Some think the carbon age will be over by 2030. Others think it will be a long transition period. The presidential race will focus on climate policy and energy transition. His view and that of others at his company is that there will be a long-term transition unfolding over decades rather than overnight. The energy industry has always been in transition, said Chevron chairman and CEO Mike Wirth recently during the Texas Oil and Gas Association's Powering Forward virtual summit. I think it's one of those least understood terms out there, Wirth said. If you look at the history of energy in the world, it's always been in transition. About 200 years ago, we had biomass as primary source of energy, burning wood and peat. Then you have oil in middle 1800s being discovered. When oil was first used, it wasn't used as fuel for airplanes or cars because they wouldn't be invented for decades to come. It was used for light as kerosene, replaced whale oil, which was the primary source of light at the time. He said the use of kerosene saved whales from extinction. Whales were being hunted into extinction, Wirth said. If it weren't for the use of kerosene for lighting, whales might have been a species that disappeared in 1800s. Ironically, save the whales is a catchphrase for protecting the environment. Our industry helped save whales. Fast forward to around the turn of the 20th century. There were incredible concerns about emissions from horses. Transportation at that time was horse-drawn. As you know, horses have solid, liquid, and gas emissions. It was a real problem in places like New York, where sanitation was suffering from the consequences. In fact, there was a conference about the Great Horse Manure Crisis of 1894. The projection was London would be covered in horse manure by 1950. That didn't happen either, because Henry Ford and innovation and technology came up with the horseless carriage and modern transportation as we see it today. Lots of technology comes as a surprise, said Yergin, pointing out that the shale revolution was also a surprise. The falling cost of solar panels is a surprise. We're more focused on technology and innovation than before. Big oil companies are putting a lot of effort into innovation. But for some goals, technology is not just available. There needs to be a lot of invention, and big oil will be a part of that with their engineering technology. Looking ahead, said Wirth, you can see all these energy forms come into the system. Technology responds to society and customer needs of the time. It responds to expectations for protecting the environment, and it's innovation and technology and markets that combine to solve these problems. As we look today at the concerns about the climate and greenhouse gas emissions, the same kinds of innovations and confidence in the markets and the ability of people to rise to the challenge will respond. That doesn't mean the end of oil and gas, Wirth said. We'll always find ways to make oil and gas more efficient, more environmentally benign. Oil and gas will be part of the energy mix, just as biomass and coal are still enormous parts of the mix and have never really gone down in terms of consumption. Oil and gas producers need to pay attention to energy transition and be part of it, said Juergen. The relationship between investors and shale companies was already getting difficult, and now shale is working to develop a new relationship, he said. Energy transition will be part of that. Report. Midland ranks as 13th fastest growing mid-sized city. By Stuart Doreen, Sdoreen, at HearstMP.com. Midland was one of the fastest growing mid-sized cities in the country, according to a report from AdvisorSmith.com. The Business Insurance Resource reports that from 2014 to 2019, Midland population grew from 128,352 to 146,038. The annual growth rate in Midland was 2.6%, which compared with an average growth rate of 0.8% for four mid-sized cities across the nation. Midland ranks 13th. On the list and was one of 14 mid-sized Texas cities to make the top 50. Frisco and McKinney, which are both located north of Dallas, were first and third, respectively. Odessa ranks 44th with a growth rate of 1.5 during the five-point period. Odessa's population grew from 114,000 to 123,000, according to the report. AdvisorSmith.com reports that it examined 226 mid-sized cities around the country, with populations between 100 and 250,000 residents. The fastest growing cities were determined by calculating the population growth rate using data from the U.S. Census Bureau. Data. Number of July virus cases more than double total through end of June. By Stuart Doreen, Doreen, at HearstMP.com. The number of coronavirus cases in July more than doubled the total number through June 30th, according to the Midland Health Department. The department reported 701 cases headed into July. When the month was over, that total had jumped to 2,179. The month of July finished with weak counts of 418 and 372 cases. That meant during those weeks, there was an average of 56.4 cases reported each day. Between mid-March and the end of May, there was a total of 129 cases. The same situation occurred with the number of coronavirus-related deaths in July. At the end of June, the health department reported 15. Through July 31st, that number had climbed to 42. With 17 during the last 2 weeks, there was an average of more than one a day. The number of recoveries also was on the rise, according to the health department. At the end of last week, there were 853. The number moved to 1,184 as of Friday. The city did not report any other details. The Texas Department of State Health Services is requiring local health departments to switch to a new software for reporting case numbers, and during the transition, updating numbers on the health department's website will be delayed, according to the city. Midland ISD to discuss reentry policy, by Stuart Doreen. Doreen at HearstMP.com. Monday is a big day for students and teachers. On that day, Midland ISD will reveal during a school board meeting its model under which students and teachers will re-enter school on August 19. The virtual meeting is set for noon and will be streamed on the district's website. There are three models Midland ISD officials will use: an on-campus instruction model, a blended instruction model, and an at-home instruction model. Each model features an option for families to enroll in the MISD Online Academy, a 100% online option. The determining factor will be the level of coronavirus community spread, the district said. A low level or no level of community spread will allow for on-campus learning. Should there be a moderate level, MISD would employ blended learning instruction. A high level of community spread would trigger at-home instruction for all students. Midland ISD will consult with local health authorities, including the Midland Health Department and Midland Memorial Hospital, about COVID-19 spread. The Midland Health Department has reported the two highest weekly coronavirus case totals over the last 2 weeks. There have been 790 confirmed coronavirus cases, an average of 395 a week, or 56.4 per day. There also is a Texas Education Agency option for reentry that allows for the school year to begin with up to 4 weeks of virtual at-home instruction. What is right for Midland is what these groups that I mentioned, MMH, the Health Department, the CDC, the community through surveys, and the information they provide, with making that determination, Midland ISD Chief of Staff Katie Aitken said. A survey recently sent out to teachers and families provided MISD officials information about support for online learning heading into the school year and teacher apprehension about going back into the classroom. The survey showed that more than 60% of the 2,082 MISD staff responded are either extremely concerned, 39.4%, or moderately concerned, 27.1%, with the impact of COVID-19 in relation to the on-campus learning working environment. It also showed 65.2% of 2,086 responding staff would support a fully virtual launch to the school year. Of the 13,690 respondents from families, more than 50.6% are interested in a full-time virtual learning option. The district also will start the school year with the Midland ISD Online Academy for those interested in a long-term virtual learning environment for their child. A family has the option to exit the Online Academy and return to on-campus instruction every 6 weeks, the end of each grading period. Atkins said last week that the difference in online learning last spring and this school year will be structure. Atkins told the Reporter-Telegram that along with the flexibility of a virtual learning environment, people also want structure and students need feedback. They said those are key to having successful learning outcomes. So that's been a big lesson learned, is how do we ensure it's true engagement and making sure that learning is occurring, not just clickety-clicking through an assignment, getting it done, turning it in, and getting a grade or a progress measure engagement, but what does engagement truly look like? The district states that attendance will be counted through daily engagement. Atkins talked about the challenges for a district moving to improve academically during the pandemic. She said it will be important for teachers and school officials to gauge students' emotional and social needs, because quality academic learning cannot take place unless officials realize where students are on those fronts. Along with identifying a student's readiness, there will be need to see the skills that students have relative to where they should be academically. Where do we need them to be and how do we get them there? Our questions, Atkins said, will be asked. There are worries about a summer slide on top of a COVID slide from last spring. I think we have to approach this with a positive and realistic expectation of support. What is taking place in the classroom will be intentionally aligned with what those essential standards are. Midland ISD has struggled when it comes to academic performance. While there weren't Texas Education Agency ratings for the 2019-20 school year, MISD trailed when it came to the district's own Lone Star governance goals. We have to be really focused on building capacity and having students delve deeper into those, what we call essential standards, to really accelerate that learning. Midland ISD staff and families will learn Monday what reentry will look like. That includes the type of instruction, where it will happen, how often some students will come to class, and other necessary information in a coronavirus setting. Midland ISD officials have stated that students in pre-K through second grade will be on campus Monday through Friday, whether the district is in on-campus instruction or blended learning instruction. The same can be said for self-contained life skills classes and self-contained autism classes. District officials said that if curricular activities take place, students can participate whether they are on campus or part of the online academy. We've been able to capture what some of these frequently asked questions and then build some responses, Atkins said, of the reentry document on the district's website. So those are there as well. And really, there are so many questions that people have about a range of topics. So we're continuing to evolve that document. The agenda for Monday's special school board meeting includes an item that calls for the approval of a waiver that allows for 40% campus hybrid instruction for students in grades 9 through 12. Agenda documents state the blended model of instruction includes students attending in person, whether Monday and Wednesday or Tuesday and Thursday, in student cohorts, while participating at home on alternating days in the asynchronous model of instruction. Learning for all students on Friday will be online. Challenges with technology on asynchronous days will be mitigated by issuing devices and hotspots in a similar model to those provided during spring 2020 instruction, according to the district. Campuses will work with families with students in multiple grade levels to ensure all students in the same family attend on the same day.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Sunday, August 2nd, 2020. Section A. UTB Professor Starts Her Own School by Ruth Campbell. Putting her educational expertise into action, University of Texas Permian Basin Assistant Professor Lindsay Baldaraz started her own school, Transformative Leadership Academy, in Monahans. Located at 2909 South Stockton Avenue in Monahans, the school last year had 52 students in grades pre-kindergarten, 3 years old, through senior. This year is projecting 64 students are expected at the private nonprofit school. Baldaraz said, students come mainly from Monahans last year, but she is expecting some from surrounding rural towns this year. Currently, the school has 4 teachers, but it ended last year with 5. Baldaraz said they are waiting to see if they are going to refill the 5th teaching position, but no final decisions have been made yet. This was quite a first year to start a new school with the global COVID-19 pandemic. It was not exactly what we expected, but honestly, we had a really good outcome, even though we had to shut down in March. But we did move to virtual learning, so we still had a lot of good learning experiences, Baldaraz said. This fall, she is looking at having school in person, virtually, and a mixture of both. She said she would prefer in-person instruction, but it depends on what the government mandates are. Baldaraz added that getting feedback from parents and understanding what is best for the students they serve is what's most important. The main thing that we've heard is that virtual learning is very hard. It's just an extreme strain on their individual families. They don't feel very well equipped to do the instruction, and also there's an element of childcare that is missing, and it really puts a strain on their family. So I know the families are really wanting if it's safe, to be able to have kids go back and do in-person learning, Baldarraz said. The school was started out of a need for an alternative option for families in the Monahans area. My background is in special education, and I've worked as a special ed advocate, and I've had a lot of people reach out to me needing assistance on trying to get the right services for their child. The current public education system is not really well suited for students who have different learning needs. And it's no fault of the actual individual systems. It's really at the state level. The mandates that are in place kind of make it hard to adjust for individual students. So there were a lot of people reaching out to me. And so a group of community leaders and business leaders kind of got together and decided that they would be able to provide the support and financial assistance to get it started. So I was selected to be the director and put my vision into practice, she said. It all kind of came about really quickly. We started the conversation about a school last March, and within 6 months were up and running, so it was very quick turnaround. I had never really thought I would start a school of my own, but just the need for providing an alternative for families was important to me. I think there's a huge, almost a grassroots movement going on in our country right now to reform education and make it more well-suited for 21st century learning. A lot of the practices that are in place don't really address the needs of our students and what they need to be capable of when they actually graduate and move into the workforce, she added. Although she's got a brand new school, Baldarraz is still an assistant professor in the special education program of the College of Education at UTPB. Having the school has helped her college students as well. I'm able to really connect with them on what's actually happening and also give them a bit of vision for what could be done in their classrooms or in their schools to really design the class from the outset to meet every student's needs, Baldarraz said. Students at TLA are of mixed ability, and Baldarraz said the school is able to meet their needs regardless of their abilities, skill sets, or interests. We have a large group of students who are very academically advanced, and they were able to move through their goals really quickly throughout the year. And then we have some students who need more time to develop, and so they're able to go at the pace that works best for them. We don't group our students based on their age, but we group them based on their skill sets and their independence level. And then they're able to move flexibly through groups throughout the year, rather than just based on the academic school calendar. There's a lot of flexibility, she said. The student-to-teacher ratio in pre-kindergarten and elementary is 12 to 1, and for secondary, it's 1 to 14. So we're really able to identify their individual needs and group them appropriately, Baldarraz said. Juggling her UTPB professorship and the school has been a challenge, but Baldarraz said one of the greatest benefits of the school is that the teachers are all extremely qualified and very strong leaders. They're able to do the majority of the day-to-day operations, and so I usually take half day in the morning at TLA and half day in the afternoon at UTPB. But then my coursework at UTPB is all online, so there's a lot of flexibility. I've had a lot of support from my dean in the College of Education. He sees the value in the school and the relevance of being able to pull from those actual experiences to teach my students, and an opportunity even to have student interns in the future come work with us at TLA. So we're able to do a lot of research as well, Baldarraz said. She said she has two research projects going on right now that involve TLA students and their families. One project that is really big and exciting that we're working on is establishing business education partnerships. We're really interested in the process and development of bringing business leaders into the school to influence our teaching, and then also an opportunity for our students to be able to go out of the school into the businesses. Last year, we had 4 different high school students interning at various places like our Sand Hills Veterinary Clinic and Atlas Sand, which is the sand mining plant. They hosted our students to intern. There also were a number of business leaders who gave workshops at the school on various topics like the cardiovascular system, germs, and hand washing. We had our bank president come in from Tejas Bank and talk to us about financial planning and really being financially savvy, understanding the purpose of things and how to set yourself up for success with your bank account. That was really beneficial, Badarez said. In this research project, she said, TLA is trying to identify specific steps for establishing business partners and then looking at the outcome of those partnerships on students to see if they're effective and useful academically and socially for students. I think it's something that people have kind of understood for a while, that businesses should have some input into education since they're kind of the final recipient of our product in education. But there's always a bit of a gap between that world and the world of education. They almost speak a different language. We have different jargon that we use, and so it's not something that happens very often, but something that's really important. So that's one research project, Valderez said. The other research project involves using 3D cameras to develop virtual reality scenarios so students can gain experience without having to physically be in a certain situation. She noted that this is especially useful for individuals with autism so they can practice skills and master them before trying them in real life. This also is useful for college students studying education. We've recognized our student interns may have limited access. There are probably going to be a lot more protocols in place. How can we bring those same internship experiences to our students? Virtual reality is probably going to be a big solution for that, she said. Balderas said TLA is accepting applications and enrollment can be done on the school website at https://thetlaacademy.com. She added that she's excited about next year, even though she's not sure exactly what it's going to look like. I'm sure we'll figure it out and make it work regardless. We have extremely supportive families who are very understanding. We bring them into the conversation every chance we get so that we know we're addressing their needs. So I think they're appreciative of that as well, Baldrez said. Lacey Spinks has all 3 of her children at Transformative Leadership Academy. I initially chose it because my middle child has sensory processing disorder and he struggled through public school and even in homeschool, Spinks said. She tried it for the small school setting, and in a matter of days, they decided it was a better fit for all 3 of their children. We have 3 children, different ages, different learning expectations, and learning abilities, so TLA has done a complete 180 for my middle child. He is excelling, and I never thought that could happen, Spinks said. She said she is definitely glad TLA was established. In a small town, there isn't usually much choice, especially for someone like her middle child. In the public school system, she said, you can find amazing teachers, while other times he would just slip through the cracks. Some days he was coming home in the middle of the day crying and experiencing sensory overload, so he wasn't learning anything, Spinks said. She added that it's not that way at TLA because all the directors, teachers, and volunteers know the different students have different learning styles. I think TLA really brings out every individual's capabilities. I guess they magnify their capabilities and it makes them feel special, Spinks said. TLA advanced primary teacher Tracy Collins instructs students who are 8 to 12 years old. Last summer, Balderas posted on Facebook that TLA was starting, and she thought it sounded interesting and decided it couldn't hurt to talk to Balderas. Balderas' vision was what Collins said any teacher dreams of. I think it actually turned out better than what I could imagine. It was an adjustment for us all, being able to let loose, being able to have the kids direct what they were interested in learning. It was a change of mindset. It was an adjustment, but we've worked through the kinks, Collins said. Dissler Retires After 30 Years by Royal McGregor. After 3 decades with the Ector County Sheriff's Office, Gary Dissler decided to retire earlier than expected. The Odessa native had previously set a retirement date at the end of 2020. However, he moved that time frame ahead a couple of months. Dissler completed his final shift as the public information officer with ECSO Friday. He said during a phone interview that he plans to continue to live in the area and relax during retirement. My plan for retirement is to be able to do things on my time, Dissler said. If I want to mow the yard in the morning, I will. Or if I want to sit here and watch the Today Show and eat breakfast until 11, that's what I'll do. After a certain time in your life, you earn that for yourself. It's time to kind of push that pause button and sit back and reflect. It's going to be time for me and my family. Dissler joined ECSO as a reserve officer in 1979. He heard about the reserve officer program during talks with Carl Rogers, who at the time was a sports anchor for KOSA TV Channel 7. Dissler's father, George Dissler, was a founding crew member at Channel 7, and he was best known for being the host of High Noon for 18 years. Throughout his high school days, Dissler figured that he would follow in his father's footsteps as a media professional. He said he knew everything he had to know to be a full-time employee for a TV station. However, Dissler said after his first ride-along experience that he joined the reserves, and slowly he started leaning toward a career at the sheriff's office. He started working full-time for the sheriff's office in 1991. He has served as public information officer for the ECSO since 2000. It's been an experience that I wouldn't trade for anything, Dissler said. Never in my life did I think I would be going into law enforcement. I thought it was going to be media all the way because that's what I grew up in. Full circle, I ended up coming back into the media as public relations. Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths said Dissler has been integral in the sheriff's office, adding a media room, which is used by Griffiths for daily updates that are broadcast to social media platforms. Gary had some media experience before he got into law enforcement, Griffiths said. It was a good fit for him for the job that he was doing. He always enjoyed doing that kind of stuff. He's experienced at it. It's one of those deals that we can fill the position, but we will never replace him. Upon retirement, Dissler said he doesn't have plans to move away from his hometown. He explained since he was born and raised in Odessa that most of his friends still reside in his area. He said he will be back to the sheriff's office, but next time as a visitor. This is my home, Dissler said. All my friends have pretty much still been around here. I have a son who is stationed in Hawaii. Our plans are to visit him as soon as this COVID-19 lets up. I would like at some point to get a house up by the lake, but my roots are still here in Odessa. ECISD goal is to keep students fed by Ruth Campbell. Although Ector County ISD's school nutrition department had been working toward feeding every child in the district, the COVID-19 pandemic accelerated those plans. Director of School Nutrition Brandon Reyes said his department was using a U.S. Department of Agriculture program called the Summer Food Service Program to provide meals. That program has its own rules, regulations, and requirements that ultimately allows us to provide meals free of charge to any child under the age of 18, with the exception of certain circumstances, Reyes said. Once school restarts August 12th, nothing extends the program beyond the summer. That meant the department had to return to its normal USDA operating programs, the National School Breakfast and Lunch Program. In anticipation of this, we wanted to make sure that we were proactive and trying to come up with a way to continue. Just because school starts doesn't mean that families aren't still having a hard time, Reyes said. He added that the Odessa's June unemployment rate was the highest in Texas at 13%. That's highly indicative of the current environment. We had plans in place to phase in universal free feeding programs anyway, but due to the pandemic, we felt it was important to accelerate that. So it's one less thing for families to worry about for this upcoming school year. The way they are able to do this is by operating two separate USDA programs. All elementary campuses are participating in what's called the Community Eligibility Provision Program. We qualify for that program through information we've received directly from the state for students who are identified as economically disadvantaged and qualify for free meals without the completion of a free and reduced meal application. These means-tested programs like SNAP, TANF, Migrant, Foster, McKinney-Vento, and things of that nature, Reyes said. SNAP stands for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. TANF stands for Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. And McKinney-Vento is a federal law under which some children are considered homeless. The threshold to qualify for the Community Eligibility Program is 40%. By combining all the elementary campuses, that percentage is 45% for ECISD. That means without completing the free and reduced application, 45% of those households qualify for free meals, Reyes noted. The funding mainly comes from the federal government, but it is also from revenue of people who pay for meals. Because the district didn't reach 40% with the middle and high schools, they decided on a universal free feeding program. Every year through this program for the middle and high schools, we are still required to send out meal applications and families complete them and turn them back in because we claim meals based off of the applications that they turn in. It's absolutely vital that if middle and high school parents who receive the application or go online to complete the meal application, it's very important that we get that participation because that's what essentially funds the program and will allow us to continue to do it in future years, Reyes said. Something that's important to note is that with the Community Eligibility Provision Program, free and reduced meal applications are not allowed to be sent out to those households. So the way that the district accounts for socioeconomic status is through income surveys. Income surveys will be distributed by the campuses this school year. And once again, it's very vital to both the district, the district's academic funding, and our ability to participate in the program that if families receive an income survey, they complete it and return it back to the respective campus so that we can account for the data that we need, he added. Reyes said his department is working to send out notification letters to households with an explanation and context to increase the likelihood of community participation. Price-wise, the programs save $495 per year for middle school families and $450 for elementary families. There's a saying that I've heard where there's no such thing as a free lunch. That's very true, but USDA offers and funds these programs. They just impose requirements for us to keep up in order to operate these programs, Reyes said. He noted that the local source of revenue is from families who pay for meals and the a la carte program, but the bulk comes from federal funding. I'm not too keen on that part of the equation, but I do know that in order for our department to be successful in implementing these programs, we will need community support by either completing an income survey if you're an elementary parent or a free and reduced meal application if you're a middle or high school parent, Reyes said. We will do our best to communicate that out as much as possible so that we're able to continue this each year going forward. The school nutrition department, including its central office staff, has 262 people. He said his team members have been working since the start of the pandemic and into the summer months, but they have not complained. This is a testament to the dedication and hard work of our team members. I have the utmost respect for them and will make sure to do right by them as much as I can throughout this process, Reyes said. Each campus has a full-service kitchen, but there are few sites where they make meals on one campus and deliver it to another location. But 95% of our meals are cooked and provided on site. It's important we have that as an advantage, Reyes said.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Monday, August 3rd, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Community Commitment. Tom Craddock, Daniel Has Forever Left an Impact on Midland, by Stuart Doreen. The history book will show that David E. Daniel was the third president at Midland College. But those who knew him best and those who worked side by side with Daniel to help advance the college's mission have so much more to say. Daniel died on July 23rd after an extended illness. Since then, the Reporter-Telegram has heard from community, college, and political leaders about the man who led Midland College to new heights during his 17 years. David's commitment to higher education has forever left an impact on the Midland community, said Tom Craddock, Midland State Representative and the longest-serving legislature in Texas history, in an email. His legacy will live on for many generations. If a man's legacy is, did he leave a place in better shape than he found it? Then Daniel's work truly speaks for itself. Under Daniel, the third of four presidents in the college's history, the institution boasted a 50% increase in enrollment to around 6,000 students, according to Midland College. His other institutions include establishing the Midland College Advanced Technology Center, establishing the Cogdell Learning Center serving South and East Midland, acquiring the Petroleum Professional Development Center in downtown Midland, developing the Midland College Williams Regional Technical Training Center in Fort Stockton, which later became the college's only branch campus, creating the Davidson Distinguished Lecture Series and the Phyllis and Bob Cowan Performing Arts Series, expanding the footprint of the main campus to include the Jack E. Brown Dining Hall, Dorothy and Todd Aaron Medical Science Building, the Leona G. and John E. Fox Science Building, and F. Marie Hall Academic Building, three residence halls, a new maintenance facility, and the Dolly Neal Chapel, and increasing the school's endowment from about $3 million to $32 million. In other words, Midland College expanded its offerings, its reach in Midland and around the region, its options for students, its value to the community, and its relevance to Midlanders' lives. Dr. Daniel was a zealot for community colleges and often said that a student successful at that level could then be successful at any four educational institution, stated David Smith, the former executive director of the Abel Hanger Foundation, in an email to the Reporter-Telegram. As evidence of his transformative nature, the depth and scope of educational offerings at Midland College increased dramatically during his tenure. Additionally, he saw Midland College as an asset of the entire community which supported it, and not merely for the students attending there. The Davidson Distinguished Lecture Series and Cowan Performing Arts Series are prime examples of that. While Daniel was a state and national leader in community colleges, serving as chair of the American Association of Community Colleges and president of the Texas Association of Community Colleges, his goal wasn't for Midland College to be just another junior college or community college, but the premier institution of higher learning in the region and a place that met the needs of the community and its residents. The college noted that in establishing the Advanced Technology Center, Daniel and school leaders created a place that provides state-of-the-art education and training in technical applications, health sciences entry-level professions, safety training, and workforce skills to high school students, college students, and employees of Permian Basin businesses. Professionally, David will be remembered for the 17 years he dedicated to establishing Midland College as one of the premier community colleges in the nation, while weaving the school into the fabric of our community, Congressman Mike Conaway said in a statement. Daniel's accomplishments are as long as the famed Midland College Circle Drive. Current college president Steve Thomas, the school's fourth president, took over the reins following Daniel's departure in 2008. He spoke of Midland College as a national leader among community colleges, but also that his desire is to carry on a tradition of excellence handled so well by his immediate predecessor. David Daniel gave 17 years of service to Midland College and the Midland community, Thomas said in a statement. He garnered tremendous community support for Midland College. Maybe that community support and respect for Midland College was exemplified most in 2005. That is when Midland College put its second ever bond before the voters. The result was 69.51% of voters approving the bond and a nearly landslide victory of 40 percentage points. Community leaders also remember Daniel for the leader he was, the staunch advocate, community builder, and incredible visionary. He had a deep and full understanding of the biblical call for personal generosity. This charismatic president, with his intelligence, sharp wit, physical presence, and booming voice, created the Midland College family, said Eileen Piewitz, executive director of the FMH Foundation and former Midland College Foundation executive director. Last month, we lost more than a Midland man, community leader, or school president. We lost one of Midland College's finest. Let those who walk the halls and travel on its grounds remember that. What they said about David E. Daniel. Midland College and the greater Midland community have lost a staunch advocate. Professionally, David will be remembered for the 17 years he dedicated to establishing Midland College as one of the premier community colleges in the nation, while weaving the school into the fabric of our community. Personally, David's friendship and sense of humor will continue on in those who knew and loved him. Suzanne and I send our deepest condolences to Dee Dee and all of David's family and friends. He will be missed. Signed, Congressman Mike Conaway. David's commitment to higher education has forever left an impact on the Midland community. His legacy will live on for many generations. Nadine and I offer our sincere condolences to the Daniels family. Signed, State Representative Tom Craddock. For 17 years, it was my pleasure to forge with Dr. Daniel a great partnership between Abel Hanger Foundation and Midland College. Dr. Daniel was a zealot for community colleges, and often said that a student successful at that level could then be successful at any four-year educational institution. As evidence of his transformative nature, the depth and scope of educational offerings at Midland College increased dramatically during his tenure. Additionally, he saw Midland College as an asset of the entire community which supported it, and not merely for the students attending there. The Davidson Distinguished Lecture Series and Cowan Performing Arts Series are prime examples of that. Due to his religious background and education, David had a deep and full understanding of the biblical call for personal generosity, as well as an appreciation for the unique relationship between donor and donee. From the time of the creation of the Students in Philanthropy program at Midland College, he helped to convey to students a duty to give back of their time, talent, and resources, which resulted in a positive character change in untold numbers of MC students. He influenced and changed a great number of lives, including my own, and left me much better for knowing him. Often, he concluded our conversations with this personal exhortation, "Continue to excel." I am forever grateful for his professional leadership at the college and our personal relationship. He will be greatly missed. Signed, David Smith, former executive director of the Abel Hanger Foundation. Eileen Piewitz's tribute to David E. Daniel. Well done, good and faithful servant. A legendary character, Dr. David E. Daniel, arrived in Midland, Texas in 1991 to serve as the third and longest tenured president, 17 years, making Midland College a shining star within the community. He quickly adapted and came to love passionately the land, the people, the spirit and lifestyle of West Texas. Daniel was already known nationally for being an activist and staunch advocate for community colleges. He quickly embarked upon making Midland College one of the premier community colleges in the United States. An incredible visionary, David's steady and wise leadership culminated in a 53% enrollment increase. A community builder, he established the Advanced Technology Center shared by the college and Midland Public School students to provide an educated technical workforce. The Petroleum Professional Development Center to support the area's major industry. The Cogdell Learning Center to serve as an outreach branch in Southeast Midland. And the Williams Technical Regional Technical Training Center in Fort Stockton to reach students who are geographically isolated. David Daniel created a legacy and set a new standard for Midland College's fiscal future when he encouraged the Midland College Foundation Board to establish the Chaparral Circle Endowment Fund, which prevented the college from suffering from the roller coaster ride of Texas's economy. Midlanders generously responded, and subsequently the Midland College Foundation held one of the top 10 community college endowments in the nation. In 2007, Dr. Daniel would thank Midland voters for passing a $42 million expansion and improvement bond for Midland College facilities by saying, "Hundreds of citizens and organizations donated time, talent, and financial resources to provide the services and means to create a beautiful and functional campus, which 25 years later is considered the gem of Midland." That love affair continues. The union of an aggressive and caring community and a college with a mission of service for all. In addition to several new and renovated academic buildings, Dr. Daniel introduced residence halls, allowing students to have a full college experience. During his tenure, the Davidson Distinguished Lecture Series and the Phyllis and Bob Cowan Performing Arts Series were established, reaching and enhancing the lives of thousands of area residents. This charismatic president, with his intelligence, sharp wit, physical presence, and booming voice, created the Midland College family. He was a mentor and a master at giving the faculty and staff tremendous independence to achieve their highest levels of excellence. Empowering the employees, encouraging students and staff to pursue their career goals through education, and leading by example, frequently bending over to pick up pieces of trash that had blown onto the beautiful campus. His gregarious and productive leadership yielded an exceptional and enthusiastic community college family. Well done, good and faithful servant, David. Rest in peace, my dear friend. Signed, Eileen Piewitz, Executive Director of the FMH Foundation. This article is entitled, "Seven Candidates Announced for MISD Board," by Stuart Doreen. At least five people have filed for seats on the Midland ISD School Board. The district reported early last week that the following have filed to put their names on the November 3rd ballot. James Fuller in District 1, Rachel Davis in District 2, Steve Vargas in District 4, Brian Murray in District 7, and Joseph Gallegos in District 7. The Reporter-Telegram already has reported on two other candidates who indicated their intentions to run for District 1 seats, Matt Galindo and Michael Booker. The Reporter-Telegram has not learned of any other candidates who have filed or announced. Four of Midland ISD's seven seats are on the ballot, and two current office holders have made re-election bids official, Fuller and Murray. The Reporter-Telegram has not talked with either Robert Marquez in District 2 or John Kennedy in District 4 about their intentions this fall. The filing period started in mid-July and continues through 5 p.m. August 17th. The Reporter-Telegram expects to have an updated list this week of those who have filed, along with additional candidate profiles. District 1 is generally in East Midland. District 2 starts in Southeast Midland and heads south. District 4 starts in Central Midland and extends to the southwest. And District 7 is in Northwest Midland. To see the school board district map, go to Midland ISD's Board of Trustees page on the district's website, midlandisd.net. A packet with application forms and other important information can be picked up at the Midland ISD Superintendent's Office, 615 West Missouri Avenue, according to Midland ISD. Because of COVID-19 guidelines, email veronica.ramirez@midlandisd.net for more information or appointment times to pick up a packet and or return the application. Midland College and Midland County Hospital District. 3 of the 9 Midland College seats are scheduled to be on the ballot in November. They are places 7, 8, and 9. Midland College's seats are at-large positions, so a person can run for any seat, and all eligible voters within the college district vote on each place. Bahola Edwards, assistant to the president and board of trustees, coordinates voting. Anyone wishing to file for the board can pick up information from her. Her office is located in the president's office, located in the PV House Administration Building. 4 of the 7 positions on the Midland County Hospital District are scheduled to be on the ballot in November. They are districts 1, 2, 5, and 6. The physical address for filing applications in person for place on the hospital district ballot is Midland Memorial Hospital, 400 Roslyn Redford Grover Parkway. Laura Isbell is the contact. This article is entitled, Some in Energy Industry Back Biden's Plan. Democratic nominee is not calling for fracturing ban. By Clifford Krause and Ivan Penn, New York Times. Joe Biden won over environmentalists and liberals when he announced a $2 trillion plan to promote electric vehicles, energy efficiency, and other policies intended to address climate change. But the plan released on July 14th has also earned a measure of support from an unexpected source, the oil and gas industry, that is closely aligned with the Trump administration and is a big source of campaign contributions to the president. That might seem odd, considering the plan aims for net zero greenhouse gas emissions by no later than 2050, in part by discouraging the use of fossil fuels. Biden also wants to spend more on mass transit, expand solar and wind farms, and build thousands of electric vehicle charging stations. Yet the industry was relieved by what the plan did not include, chiefly a ban on hydraulic fracturing, the approach that has turbocharged domestic production of oil and gas over the past dozen years. There is a lot of room in there for oil and gas, said Matt Gallagher, president of Parsley Energy, about the Biden plan. Some executives were particularly enthusiastic that Biden wanted the federal government to invest in carbon capture and sequestration, which entails preventing emissions of greenhouse gases from reaching the atmosphere and thus allowing the industry to continue burning fossil fuels for decades. In a sign of his all-inclusive, eclectic approach to energy, Biden is proposing the use of advanced nuclear reactors to produce electricity. There is some common ground, said Mike Summers, president of the American Petroleum Institute, which represents the industry in Washington and is close to the Trump administration. We appreciate the fact that they recognize that there is going to be a role for natural gas and oil in our future. We share the broad goal of reducing emissions and addressing climate change. Oil and gas executives noted that they had worked productively with Democratic administrations. During the Obama administration, oil companies enjoyed handsome profits even as federal regulators implemented tougher environmental regulations. Sharif Tsuki, a Houston entrepreneur who pioneered the liquefied natural gas export industry, expressed enthusiasm about the Biden plan. At first blush, the plan is a masterpiece because he gives something to everybody, said Tsuki, executive chairman of Tellurium, a gas producer that is planning a major export terminal in Louisiana. Investment in infrastructure is great. $400 billion for research and development is phenomenal and way overdue. Like almost all the fossil fuel executives, however, Tsuki had some reservations. He described Biden's goal of eliminating carbon emissions from the electricity sector by 2035 as unrealistic and unachievable. He said, Biden ought to strive for carbon neutrality, in which emissions from power plants would be offset by planting trees and using technology to suck carbon out of the air. Of course, most oil and gas executives would prefer President Donald Trump be reelected because he has spent the past 3.5 years rolling back regulations. Fossil fuel interests have donated 7 times more to the Trump campaign than the Biden campaign through June, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonprofit research group. Those numbers are skewed in part because Trump has been raising money since he took office in 2017. The president's most ardent supporters in the energy industry said Biden's plan was craftily intended to appear moderate so he could compete with Trump in states that produce oil and gas. He wants to win Pennsylvania, so he toned down that rhetoric for obvious reasons, said Kathleen Sgama, president of the Western Energy Alliance in Denver. Coal executives are downright hostile toward Biden. Their overall motive is to do away with coal miners and coal use in this country, said Bill Rainey, president of the West Virginia Coal Association. Yet energy executives have complaints with the Trump administration, too. Some natural gas executives privately grouse that the president's trade war has cost them dearly because China, the world's biggest gas importer, has bought only 3 cargoes of liquefied natural gas from the United States over the past 22 months. Steph Feldman, the Biden's campaign policy director, said it was not surprising that some oil and gas executives were open to some of Biden's ideas. More and more energy companies are realizing the reality of climate change, the direction consumers are headed, the direction other businesses are headed, and they're making changes as a result, he said.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.